Washington Post Live's This is Climate Tipping Point Summit is presented by 3M and Ecolab.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Good morning and welcome back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Juliet Eilprin, Deputy Climate and Environment Editor at The Post. Joining me now is marine biologist and photographer Christina Mittermeier, who traveled to D.C. from New Zealand to join us here today. Christina, thank you so much for joining us here at the
Juliet,
Post.
Juliet, thank you.
So to start, for years, wildlife photographers have spoken out for conservation. You are a pioneer in the development of conservation photography. Can you tell us what you're trying to communicate through conservation photography?
Yeah, conservation photography was an idea born out of the necessity for action. I was part of a community of nature photographers, and there's this, you know, tendency to just go and take pretty pictures. You want to get published, you want to, you know, be in magazines. But I understood that if you put those photographs along with the stories that they come with in front of the people that may or may not know about issues, you have a chance to influence the way people think. And so it's the advocacy work that goes with photography.
Got it. You grew up pretty far from the closest ocean. When and why did you turn your attention more specifically to protecting the oceans?
You know, books are so important in the formation of a child's mind. And to me, I read two books that were very influential in my life. One was Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb. I don't know if you were scared along with me in the 1980s. And the other one was just Jacques Cousteau and the invitation to adventure, the mystery of this ecosystem we know so little about.
Yeah. And the Post has reported on the unprecedented streak of ocean heat entering a second year that scientists say could potentially, you know, cause an irreversible change to Earth systems. Are we reaching a tipping point with the oceans, whether you're talking about coral reefs or other key components in the ocean?
You know, one of the things that frustrates me about scientists is their reluctance to just tell us what's what. And for those of us who spend a lot of time in the ocean, absolutely, it is getting warm all around. And in places like the eastern coast of Australia, the Great Barrier Reef, yeah, it's several degrees warmer than it should be. So as a result, you know, we're losing things that we can see, like coral reefs. But it is the things that we cannot see, like the planktonic communities that, you know, through photosynthesis provide oxygen. Those are the terrifying ones. To me, the most scary part of the whole story, Juliet, is that we know so little about how things work and how these tipping points are going to be interconnected with one another. Mm-hmm. We're basically piloting a spaceship through the universe that we know very little about.
Now, you've said, as we saw at the beginning with the video, that oceans are both a victim of and a solution to climate change. Can you give a specific example of how they can be a solution?
Yes. I mean, anything that is doing the work that's a quarter, you know, 25% of a solution is pretty important. You cannot drive a vehicle with just three tires. You need the fourth one, too. The ocean is absorbing 25% of emissions. It does this naturally. We don't pay it to do it. You know, we don't ask it to do it. It just does it. But it's also producing 50% of the oxygen we breathe. And it absorbs 90% of the excess heat in the atmosphere. So it lends us an incredible service. And it can only do it if it's alive. And people think that ocean is just salt water. But no, it's a living broth of microorganisms, algae. That is where life emerged from in this planet. And it's what keeps this planet alive. So as we ignore it, you know, and it's shockingly the most underfunded of all the sustainable development goals by a lot, and conservation in general, environmental work in the ocean is severely underfunded as well. Yeah. So we need to keep it alive.
And news broke recently about indigenous groups in New Zealand, Tahiti, and the Cook Islands signing a treaty that recognized whales as legal persons. How might this, and we've also seen this, you know, in Panama with leatherback turtles, how might this help lead to further legal protections?
I love spending time in the company of societies that I don't understand, including societies like whales. They are fellow passengers on Spaceship Earth, and we know very little about, you know, how they communicate, how they operate, but they absolutely lend an incredibly valuable service to humanity. And we're learning more about the role that not just whales, but biomass in the ocean in general plays in the carbon cycle. Mm-hmm. We need these, you know, animals to help us, you know, things like, think about a whale, how big it is. I'm looking at these photographs. Yeah. the amount of carbon in the body of a whale, and when it dies, of course, it sinks to the bottom of the ocean. Right. But throughout its life, this whale is feeding in the depths, and it's eating very mineral-rich nutrients. And then it poops on top of the surface of the ocean, and this is fertilizer that promotes the growth of plankton that, of course, you know, produces oxygen, sequesters carbon, the whole cycle. I think that the fact that indigenous people, not just in New Zealand, not just in the Cook Islands, in all over the world really, are taking a leadership role in reminding us that we need these biodiversity elements to survive. And I believe firmly that whales deserve personhood. They are valuable assets, not just in economic terms, but just culturally. And I mean, I want to live in a planet where there's whales.
A recent piece about you and your partner, Paul Nicklin, said that because the two of you spend your lives on the front lines of the climate crisis, you could be compared to wartime photographers. I wanted to know what you think of that. Is that a fair comparison? Would you challenge part of that?
You know, you feel very humbled when you're out in nature and when you witness what happens, for example, with the industrial fishing fleet. I mean, it is a war on nature. It is so unsustainable to think that we can exploit any resource in that manner. But it happens out there in the middle of nowhere. It's invisible to most people. And a lot of us, we only understand fish because we see it swimming in a, you know, a sea of butter, a plate of butter. But fish are wildlife, and you start understanding the destruction of, you know, the bottom of the ocean through deep sea mining. And yes, there is a need for minerals, but we cannot just wholesale destruct entire ecosystems that we know so little about. So yes, I feel like we are reporters out in the middle of nowhere bringing stories about the most important ecosystem on planet Earth. And it's a pretty lonely job, Juliet.
And as you said, you go out into the world and take these photographs. How do you track what impact conservation photography, whether yours or others, have on the world?
I think it's the hardest part of the job. We never know the impact that our photographs have. I firmly believe that photography is a great way of inviting people into what I think is the most important conversation of our times, really, the survival of our planet. And a lot of people don't feel competent enough to enter the conversation on climate. You know, they don't know enough about it. Nobody wants to feel ignorant. Photography lowers the price of entry. It invites people to ask questions. And it's just a way for us to make the audience larger. But to track the impact is almost impossible. You know, I just hope that we are having impact.
And one related question, which is, what are the kinds of images that you think have the biggest impact on the public consciousness? Would it be uplifting images or images that create an uproar? Because you've obviously shared both.
Oh, this is such a good question. I derive a lot of inspiration from Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, he didn't start the famous speech by telling us he had a nightmare. He told us that there's a dream, right? And creating aspirational images of the kind of planet that we want to live in, I think, is valuable. At the same time, you know, we need to remind people that we are in a lot of trouble. And those images need to be very carefully punctuated throughout the conversation because people don't want to feel hopeless. They don't want to feel despair. And so you have to keep this narrative going.
Yeah, and we have a couple of photos that the audience is seeing. Could you just tell us a little bit about both of them so they have a sense?
Yeah, so we have a stellar sea lion, a beautiful animal that's taken in front of my home in British Columbia. And this urchin, you know, it can be a beautiful thing, but when you lose the ecological balance in some places like the coast of California, where we have removed a lot of the top predators, urchins can become a massive problem. We're seeing this in New Zealand, in California, in British Columbia. But you try to tell these stories in a way that's whimsical. On the other side, we have a polar bear that we encountered during an expedition to the Canadian Arctic. Yeah. And we are seeing more and more bears stranded on land. They don't get enough food. They are starving. It's a very, very sad thing to watch. Yeah. The funny thing about this image, it's how much controversy it caused. It really created this narrative that there's too many polar bears because now polar bears are so hungry that they're going to villages, so we see many more. That doesn't mean there's more polar bears. I think they are in a lot of trouble, and you know, facing issues like climate, but also trophy hunting.
Got it. Now, we have an audience question from Amy Loeffler in Alaska, amazing state. What would you tell aspiring climate journalists who might feel like their reporting falls on deaf ears?
You know, as a reporter, you really never know who's going to see your work, who's going to read your words. And the job is not to be paying attention to that. The job is just to tell the story, right? So don't go out there, you know, worried about how many people are reading it. You just have to do the work. And you know what? We need an army of storytellers and photographers and journalists out there reporting on the state of the planet. So just go do it.
There you go. You and I spoke over a decade ago, because we've known each other for a long time, about the intersection of your work and politics. You said that politicians are afraid of conservation images. Is that still true today?
I don't think so. I think things have changed dramatically, especially in this country. It's so rewarding to see an administration like President Biden's administration who really cares about these things. The concern is that politicians are not always well versed in these subjects. You know, you have ministers of the environment that are appointed, and they're politicians. They are not biologists. What I think is important is that they listen to the scientists. Scientists are the pilots. They're the ones who know how planet Earth works. Let's not ignore their advice, and politicians should be sitting always next to a scientist.
And then related. Okay. While we're on policy, what message would you want to communicate to American officials here while in Washington?
The most important thing I can say is I travel all over the world. I talk to politicians all over the world. And yes, everybody is watching America. What we do or don't do really matters. And so let's just engage in American conservation, environmental work with the knowledge that the rest of the world is following us or not.
And once you're done, you're going to go back to down under to Australia. Could you talk a little specifically about what you're doing there and kind of how you do your work? What does it mean to actually be out doing both photography and conservation?
You know, I went to New Zealand first. The boat was there for 3 months. And I was so excited because I thought of New Zealand as a country that cares about conservation. But a country that's 93% ocean has barely protected 0.3% of their waters. And I thought that was pathetic. And you can see the effects that this is having. You know, there's just rampant fishing. Everybody has a right to fish. And so you want to tell them, you know, I've seen what happens to countries that do this. You know, be warned. From there, we're going to Australia. Our boat arrived yesterday. We are there because the water is so warm that the scientists we're working with are saying we're going to lose 90% of the Great Barrier Reef this year. 90%. I mean, let's just stop for a second and think about this is a habitat. This is something that we can see from space. And people say things like, oh, we can restore it. You can't. Losing these types of ecosystems, what we need to know is that it's irreversible. And it is catastrophic, and it's going to have tremendous impact for the communities, first where the coral reefs are, but eventually for all of us. This causes all sorts of issues with increased storms and migration, and it's devastating. So I feel it's really important for journalists to be there to make sure that it's not just a blip in the news cycle. You know, this is a big deal. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there obviously we have seen in recent months, you know, both a global treaty on biodiversity, these goals of 30 by 30. We're right now in negotiations over whether there's a possibility to reach a global plastics treaty, which obviously has critical implications for the for the planet. What do you, and for the ocean specifically, you know, what do you think of these efforts, and what will it take to actually make them, you know, not just a paper agreement, but have real impact?
I think these treaties are so important. Climate treaty, biodiversity treaty, now this global plastics treaty. What they require is a lot of public support. We need a population that is informed and engaged and pushing politicians to keep doing the right thing. Because if these treaties are negotiated in dark rooms in some, you know, obscure conference, then nobody cares. But they are critically important. I mean, the future life on Earth depends on these treaties, and they really outline how humanity is going to go forward or not.
Right. And is there anything, and when you, how have you encountered, for example, plastics in the ocean and, and that impact as you've been out in the field?
The more we learn about plastics, Juliet, the more terrifying it becomes, because it's not the stuff that we can see. Of course, plastics break down and, you know, we think about microplastics and we know that we're all eating it. It is the chemicals in plastics that are devastating. You know, I learned yesterday, 16,000 chemicals go into plastics. We only know what 3 of them do to human health. all of these chemicals leaching into the environment have an effect not just on humans, on our babies, our children, but also on these ecosystems. New studies are saying that these chemicals are impacting ecosystems like reefs as well. And we have a chance with the upcoming negotiations on the Global Plastics Treaty to actually, you know, create language that is strong enough to say, let's turn the tap off and not create any new plastic. Let's learn how to reuse the plastic that we have and use alternatives. So I hope that, you know, these negotiations go well.
Okay. And this will be our last question. So much in the literature out there about climate change is, of course, about doom and gloom. So to provide us with a little optimism, in one sentence, what makes you hopeful that people will take action to be better caretakers for the planet?
I think hope is a personal choice, Juliet. You know, there's many days when I wake up and I think, oh my God, we're doomed. And then I remember, you know, I cannot allow myself to feel or think that way. So I make the choice of remaining hopeful. And I think hope is a powerful motivator for all of us. So I'm doing a book about hope.
So we'll have to leave it there. Christina, thank you again for making the journey.
Thank you.
And best of luck to you on your next expedition.
Good afternoon, and I'm Robin Gavon, Senior Critic at Large here at The Post. And today I'm joined by two young activists who are using animation, fashion, and their own stories to shape new narratives about climate change. Quanah Chasing Horse is a land protector and model. And Maya Penn is an environmentalist, filmmaker, and founder of the fashion line Maya's Ideas. Thank you so much for being here. So, Quanah, I thought I would start with you. You're a fourth generation, correct, land protector. And I'm hoping that you can, first of all, just sort of define what land protector means and perhaps how it differs from being an environmentalist and how that shapes your approach to climate change.
Yeah, I feel like that's a really great way to start this conversation, because I feel like a lot of people are like, what's the difference between an activist and a land protector? And it's a little bit more complicated than a lot of people think, but it really waters down to the fact that a lot of indigenous people contribute the least to a lot of these climate catastrophes, yet we, you know, are most affected by it, or like BIPOC communities are most affected by it. And to really just show up and like explain that our people are always at the forefront. Our voices are always at the forefront. There's so many, I would say, not just like protests, but, you know, Standing Rock, for instance, like there were so many land protectors there showing up, doing the work, putting their lives at risk for this work to defend our land and our ways of life, and to really show the world that like what's happening in our communities is like detrimental, not just to us, but to everyone else. What happens in our communities will affect everyone else in their communities. And you know, for me, I can just be like, oh, I'm an activist. But when I think about it, like my ways of life are at risk. Like back home in Alaska, we're facing so much climate catastrophes every single year. You know, the salmon are almost extinct. Our people are banned from fishing. And that's how we sustain our communities and are able to feed our families, because a lot of the stores in the villages, it's like $15 for a bag of chips. So a lot of our people don't have the money to pay for groceries like that if a carton of milk is like $20 to $30. And so it's so important that we are able to sustain ourselves and live off the land continuously, because it's not affordable. And living out in the bush of Alaska is a hard way of life, but that's who we are as a people. That's what keeps us grounded and showing up and being able to voice our experiences, because our experiences are at the forefront. So it's not just like, oh, I'm passionate about this work and I see how it's affecting other people, but I see how it's affecting my family, myself, my mom's dog team, and my people. And so I think that's just like, you know, a line that I walk where it's like, you know, I can claim to be an activist, but at the end of the day, I'm a land protector, because it waters down to the importance of I'm protecting my own ways of life and my culture and my identity as an indigenous person.
That's really powerful. Thank you for that. Maya, you've talked a lot about how animation and art have always been your first loves, and you've been working, on your animated directorial debut with a film called Asali. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Asali, Power of the Pollinators. And you've got some pretty powerful executive producers, Viola Davis and Julius Tenen. Can you talk a little bit about the story that you're wanting to tell through this through this film?
Absolutely. Well, so I've been an environmentalist and a really focused on solutions-based work in the environmental and climate space since I was 8 years old. So now being 24, this year I'll be in this space for 16 years. And I've always been
an OG at this point.
I am an OG. I'm a pathfinder in the Gen Z, like, environmentalist space, right? Because I started at a time before the climate strike, and, you know, when we started to really have a larger platform on a more mainstream scale. And the reason why I'm very passionate about utilizing multiple different mediums for environmental education, as well as really reshaping the narrative of what climate media is because media and storytelling are absolutely critical to saving our planet, to not only educating people, because I feel like in many ways we're past an awareness standpoint, and now it's time to zero in more onto some of the more underserved areas within environmentalism and translate powerful storytelling into real-world tangible action for people of all ages. So being an animator, animation is one of my favorite mediums of storytelling. It's very universal, and it's so flexible, and you can, reshape someone's perspective on what's happening in reality while also creating a, world that's, imaginative and that can really expand your mind on what's possible, right? So I started my own production company called Ependo Productions, and we are focused on job creation for next-gen artists, especially Gen Z and Black, Brown, and Indigenous, women, disabled, queer artists, etc., around the world. Even just on Asali alone, we are working with amazing.
And can I just yes. interrupt for a quick second mm-hmm. to just, you mentioned Asali again. Can you tell us just specifically what that is about? Just a little thumbnail?
Yeah, absolutely. So Asali is an environmental action adventure. It is focused on, oh, there she is. Asali is an environmental action adventure. It is
See how
centered
I did that?
Around the, it's centered around some of our most crucial creatures for our planet, pollinators. Not only bees, but a variety of pollinators. And, they're so intrinsically linked to human life. Mm-hmm. Without them, we would really have a complete agricultural and ecological collapse. Yeah. So pollinators has always been something I've been really passionate about. I actually created this story. I showed it during my TED Women Talk, one of my three TED Talks that I gave when I was 13 years old. It was a concept at the time. That talk went viral worldwide, was translated into over 100 different languages. And to this day, people ask me, when are you making more Asali? Like, I showed this to my students and they thought it was awesome and they want to see more, right? And this is like a 30-second long animation I made when I was 12. And so now it's coming to life. Showcasing the connection not only between pollinators and humans, there's an environmental scientist character in here voiced by Monique Coleman. There's a forest guardian voiced by Whoopi Goldberg, a number of, various, kind of showing the interconnectedness.
I'm curious, you mentioned that you started when you were 8 years old. Was mm-hmm. there a sort of a precipitating event that made you really wake up to the climate crisis? Was it something that was always a conversation in your family? Like, what sparks an 8-year-old, not just to think about it, but to actually to take action?
Well, I, really come by it, honestly, I grew up in a very eco-conscious household. And, both my mom and my dad have always, had a connection with the environment. So my mom was the first, person to, we started an organic garden together because that's something that she did, with her mom when, she was at the time like 8 around my age and, getting me really communing with nature. And then my dad, when he was a teenager, he was creating solar energy projects for science fairs and getting awards from NASA for them. And, we've really felt the impact of
environmental issues and environmental disaster. When my mom was around my age, she actually experienced Hurricane Hugo and experienced, you know, homelessness as a result of living through that hurricane, you know, coming outside and seeing your neighbor's house looks like a dollhouse because the whole front is ripped off, you know.
So it's really rooted in your family and kind of in your DNA.
Absolutely, yes.
Quanah, you've been to D.C. Before. You've lobbied on Capitol Hill to preserve the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I know that you've done work protesting the Willow Project. I mean, can you talk a little bit about how much of climate solution is up to governments, and how much do you think is really up to individuals to simply say no to certain ways that they've become accustomed to that are damaging to the environment?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a lot of people from Alaska, even people from outside of Alaska that I've been seeing, you know, what's been unfolding in Alaska. But I will say, like, when I first started this work, it was really just like a bunch of youth and a lot of our tribes that was supporting the youth and being like, you know, you're from here, share your experiences and like just get them connected to the humanness of this issue. Because, what you know, you can look at the data, you can see the science in front of you, but if someone isn't going to sit there and tell you their lived experience in the climate crisis, how are they going to really care about it? And so, you know, a lot of the lobbying and a lot of the work that we've done has just been, you know, getting people to realize that this work is rehumanizing us as Indigenous people and BIPOC people in our communities that really face these, you know, catastrophes. Like your family, you know, that lived experience, that's telling in itself. And so, you know, just getting people not just aware of it, but to learn about not just the data, but the humanness, and there's people that live on the front lines that have to deal with this on a day-to-day basis. And we've lost lives in Alaska to the climate crisis. There's people that went out thinking that it was safe to go out, but they lost their life due to the climate crisis.
Maybe go out on the ice. Or
And you know, there's specific times and points in the year where it is safe to go out on the ice. You usually measure it, you usually can tell there's actually, you know, certain paths and certain routes that we take that we know are safe because that's how we were built into it. But they're not safe anymore. And so being on Capitol Hill and visiting with some of the, you know, change makers, the people that really are voting on these laws and bills, getting them connected to that humanness and hearing our stories and not just being a statistic, but being a person, you know, that is really like a big part of the work that we do, because I feel like a lot of the time our voices are so overlooked because they're like, oh, they don't know the science, they don't know this, they don't know that. Well, we do know way more than a lot of people like to admit because we have that lived experience.
Well, your description of, you know, a familiar pathway onto the ice no longer being safe, it's a little bit like describing a roadway that you've always used that suddenly collapses under you.
That's actually what has happened a lot in Alaska as well. So that's another thing. And, you know, with the Willow Project, that was honestly really scary for us because we weren't sure how that was going to unfold. You know, there's a lot of people that were on the fence. There's a lot of people that were like, you know, the economy, this and that. But it's, again, like, at the end of the day, if you really see the effects that these projects are going to have in long term, it's honestly going to be way more detrimental to our ecosystem and our economy as a whole, because then there's going to be nothing left. And I think being so young and not just listening in on these conversations, but having a voice in it has really opened my eyes to so many different other perspectives. And being in DC and, you know, sharing my story, but also listening to other people and their experiences, it has all honestly given me so much more knowledge, and I'm able to share that with them as well. So it's, you know, a lot of like emotional labor to like really sit there and try to explain to them how much our people and the animals and our ways of life are suffering, but we have to do it because there is no other way to get people to care about it.
Maya, I know you've been out there protesting during like Climate Week. I mean, are there ways that you see the climate emergency, as you've referred to it, sort of, have you seen it personally versus existentially?
I really love that question because
I think that one of the most crucial things about this movement in this space is to make it personal. When people ask me, Maya, you know, what advice do you have for me? I feel so helpless with all of the, you know, environmental issues and climate change and everything that's happening. What can I do? And my first piece of advice is always to make it personal. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter who you are, what your background is, where you're from, what industry you're in, there is a very good chance that climate connects to it in some way. Climate is the multiplier, right? It is the umbrella for everything that we care about as human beings. Any cause that we care about or industry that, you know, we're working in on this earth is impacted or will be impacted by climate change in some degree. And so I definitely agree with your point. For me, I'm using my work as someone who's certified in circular economies and sustainable strategies, also as an entrepreneur with sustainable fashion, with filmmaking, with animation, with my books that are being used in curriculum in schools from Cincinnati to India. And so it's really important to think about where you already are, you know, take that as your stepping stone to start and connect it. Look for those overlaps and those intersections between, you know, who you are, what you care about, what your work is, and climate, because there already is one that exists. Yep. And everyone has, you know, a voice in this space. And it's really about taking the initiative to just take control of how you want your voice to be heard and how you want to show up, right? And I think, too, again, like just an example of making it personal. I'm someone who does a lot of work also in women and girls' rights. And you know, that's something that's been incredibly crucial to me with my nonprofit organization, Maya's Ideas for the Planet. And we've done a lot of work since 2011, 2012 in period poverty in the US and Haiti and Senegal, Cameroon, et cetera, and a number of other work around getting more women and girls into non-traditional fields within environment and climate. And initially, most people might feel like that's somewhat disconnected, but the UN, you know, per the UNDP, women and children are 14 times more likely to die in an environmental disaster. And numerous studies have also shown the impact that girls and women having access to education, funding and resources creates more climate resiliency for entire communities, right? So everybody wins. So that's just like one example of how everything that we care about is interconnected with climate, because we all live on this planet, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Quanah, I want to get in at least one more question to you, and it's about sort of about allyship. Mm-hmm. And I know that you're, you know, involved in the fashion industry. You're kind of in the belly of the beast of one of the notorious polluters. So how do you find allies within that space, or how do you bring allyship to work for you when you're in that space and you're dealing with designers and production companies and all of those things?
Man, it's been a journey. It's been a challenge. I've been only doing this, well, in fashion specifically, for 3 years. You know, I've been doing advocacy work like her since I was really young. But man, it's been a journey. But you know, I think the best thing is to, you know, address these things with compassion, mm-hmm. and understanding, because a lot of the time, like, the fashion industry knows what they're doing, but a lot of the time, like, it's hard to get people to see it, like, clearly, because they're so, like, the fashion industry is such a fast pace, like, everywhere, like, it's not organized, and it can be disastrous at times. But I've been very fortunate to work with really influential people in the fashion industry. Because before...
Do you find that they will listen to what you have to say about where they may be going wrong?
Yeah, and I think the best way that I was able to kind of enter the fashion space was to, like, hold on tight to my advocacy work and not let up and to not compromise. Like, if you want to work with me, you compromise for me. I don't compromise for you. These are what I stand for. These are the things that I'm working on. These are the things that I will not, you know, work with you on because of your, you know, sustainability practices to, you know, social issues and whatnot. But it's been definitely, I've had conversations that were really awkward. I've had conversations that were really tough and, like, really just not very focused, because every time that you try to have these conversations, they want to redirect it to something because they don't want to be so focused on the negative. That's always the thing, is they're always trying to be like, oh, this is so negative. Like, you know, there's so many good things in the world. But it's like, yeah, but we can't have those good things if there's also so many bad things happening. We need to recognize and address these bad things so that we can continue to have these good things. And it's like, it's also like that in the outdoor industry. I'm also in the outdoor industry. I'm a snowboarder. I was just hanging out with Burton and their athletes. And, you know, a lot of them are, you know, trying to get into advocacy space because they're realizing, oh, our seasons are getting shorter. We're not getting enough snow. And I'm just like, okay, well, if that's what you care about, I can help you on that journey. And so it's really just finding a like minds, making sure that they understand who you are, where you come from, and don't let up. Because if you let up, it'll just show that they can take advantage of you and your voice and your work. Because like activists like us, you know, I think we were just talking about this back there, like we have shown up 10 toes down, fully like trying to make the fashion space, you know, accessible to everyone, including activists. Mm-hmm. And that's how we create change, is by sitting at the table, having those conversations, whether it be harder or like awkward, you have to talk about them.
Yeah. Well, so I have the hard news to say that we are out of time, I'm afraid. But I appreciate all that you both said so much. Thank you all for listening.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.